Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
Let me tell you about Today Tix. I always thought Today Tix was for last-minute tickets, but what most people don't know is that you can buy tickets months in advance. So if you're feeling spontaneous or just want to browse, you know you're getting the best prices when you go through the Today Tix app. Right now, go to todaytix.com/guide and use promo code GUIDE to get $10 off your first Today Tix purchase. Today Tix is so convenient that Forbes magazine calls it the Uber of Broadway tickets. Find a show in your hometown or even while you travel. They offer tickets for theater, live comedy, dance, opera, immersive theatrical experiences, and more. And they're all more affordable than you think. There's something going on in your city and you don't want to miss out. Go to todaytix.com/guide and use promo code GUIDE to get $10 off your first Today Tix purchase. That's promo code GUIDE at todaytix.com/guide for $10 off your first ticket purchase. todaytix.com/guide. Go get them.
For nearly 30 years, Todd Garner has overseen blockbuster films like Con Air, Anger Management, Triple X, 13 Going on 30, and Black Hawk Down.
Why are they letting you make these movies?
Join Todd as he shares tips and stories from the front lines of producing in Hollywood.
I'm Adam Sandler.
I'm Rebel Wilson.
This is Jeff Probst.
I'm Kaylee Cuoco.
I'm Eli Roth.
This is Marlon Wayans.
Hey, it's Ed Helms.
This is Shay Mitchell.
Everybody, this is Kevin James, and this is The Producer's Guide.
The Producer's Guide.
The Producer's Guide.
The Producer's Guide with Todd Garner.
Todd Garner.
Todd Garner.
Todd Garner.
What a combination.
As anybody who's listened to this podcast knows that I love the history of the movie business. I love talking to guys that were doing this for a long time. I like to talk about old movies, the way they were made, because I find it fascinating that the more things change, the more they stay the same. And today's guest is by far no exception. Hawk Koch is a good friend of mine. We've worked together before when I was at Disney on a movie called Keeping the Faith. And he is a legacy in this business. Not only is he a legend in his own right, having worked on movies in the 70s as an assistant director, such as Going Home and The Way We Were and Parallax View and Chinatown and Marathon Man. But as a producer, he's produced some of my favorite films. He's produced Heaven Can Wait, The Idolmaker, Gorky Park, The Pope of Greenwich Village, and Wayne's World, to name just a few. And he has a new book coming out, which is something I could never do, to be able to sit down and actually put your memoirs together and organize them in a way that not only tell the story of your life, but also is informative and also is a way to teach people about the movie business. And again, part of the reason I did this podcast, to give insider view of how to get in the business and how to work hard and how to put the pieces together to build a career as a producer. The book is called Magic Time, My Life in Hollywood. It comes out November 12th, 2019. You can get it on Amazon. You can actually pre-order right now. It's fantastic. I really enjoyed talking to him about not only how he got his very unusual but very cool name, but also how he came out from under his very famous father and built a life on his own in Hollywood, as the book says. Enjoy. All right, I'm here with Hawk Koch. Hi, Hawk. How you doing, man? Right, thanks for doing this.
I'm excited to do it. It's nice to see
you. It's nice to see
another
you.
Producer
That's
here.
That's right. Yes. You know that we worked together in 2000 on Keeping the Faith.
Yes.
I was at Touchstone when you right. produced that movie for yes. Spyglass.
Yes.
And
Glickman still says it's his favorite movie that he ever made over there.
So great. And you had two movies going at the same time, right? You had Frequency also?
Frequency,
at the same time?
Yes.
And correct me if I'm wrong, is that the first movie you were Hawk on? As a producer?
No. Okay. No, I got bar mitzvahed for my 50th
right,
birthday
I know that.
In 1995, and Primal Fear
came 2000, right.
Yeah, so I had done several movies
okay.
that time.
So I want to get into that. So you are the son of Howard Koch Sr.,
yes.
who had a long storied career, obviously, including being chairman of Paramount or
head of production of Paramount.
Well, yeah, it was a different time.
And
different
head of
time.
Sinatra's company
yeah,
before that.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. And so you grew up in the movie business. Like your first horse ride was with
Clark Gable.
So your summers basically were going to sets of your dad's movies.
Kanab, Utah. I work with the grips, the electricians, the prop guy, the DP, the cameraman, everybody.
And did you always know you wanted to be in the movie business, or was it just sort of a way to connect with your dad and go and be around him when he was on set?
It was a magical place for me.
Which is why your book is called that.
That and because I was lucky enough to work with Jack Lemmon twice in the 1960s.
You've been lucky to work with a lot of good people, my friend. As an assistant director, you worked with all the greats.
Right.
By the way, did you see in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, your movie that you assistant directed on Rosemary's Baby is talked about quite a bit.
And Chinatown.
Yes,
I'm
right.
On both, and then
exactly.
We were next week or whenever it is.
Yes.
In the 60s, I talk about The Manchurian Candidate, which my dad made. So.
Right. Both made by...
I just wanted to say that Magic Time is because Jack Lemmon... In Days of Wine and Roses, when he before he takes a drink, he would go Magic Time and take a drink.
Right.
He used that mantra every time before he was about to shoot a scene.
Wow.
If somebody yelled roll action, he'd go Magic Time and he'd turn to do and he'd get into character.
It was just a reset for him.
So for me, all the years of behind the video camera, or if I had to go back up on stage like at the Oscars, I would say Magic Time before so that I would kind of focus on what I was doing.
So you started off in this business, though, once you realized you were there movies specifically when you were growing up that you went, that's what I want to do? Was there anything like that, or was it really just being behind the scenes and seeing how the sausage was made?
First one that really hit me was the Ten Commandments in that giant screen.
Sure.
Then
do you remember where you saw it? Did you see it in the Dome?
The Stanley Wiltern Theater, which is on Cannon and Wilshire. It's no longer there.
Right.
But it was a great theater.
Now, did your dad have a screening room at the house, and was he part of that Beverly Hills sort of circuit where you guys were seeing movies first run in your home?
No, my dad made B movies in the 50s. He was an assistant director before that, and he in 1960 he got two offers in the same day. One, to be the partner of Quinn Martin in television, who was making Untouchables,
sure.
FBI, blah, 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 blah.
Sure.
And he thought, wow, this would be great. And then he got a call from Mickey Rudin, to say, would you meet with Frank Sinatra because he wants you to run his company.
Wow.
So when he got that is when all of a sudden a few more bucks came in.
Sure.
But by the time they moved to North Crescent Drive, I was out of the house and I was
You're long gone.
Yes.
So you started off as a PA on, by the way, not even B movies, right? You started off on a couple of crazy little horror movies in 1965.
One of the greats, Billy the Kid versus Dracula and Jesse James meets Frankenstein's daughter. I mean, how much better are those, huh?
And were there like 5-day shoots or something like that?
5 days each. For one scene, you'd have the stagecoach go left to right. As they were turning around to go back to number one, you'd shoot right to left for the other movie.
Right, perfect. Wow. So it was two movies being shot at the same time,
yes, yes.
Separated out. How did those come out back in the day?
I don't think anybody saw them. But the next film was This Property is Condemned. Natalie Wood and a young actor named Robert Redford in his second movie, Sidney Pollack's second movie. He had done The Slender Thread first. And I was a PA. I was sent down by the production manager to go and set up Mississippi.
Right.
He wanted his son to be the PA, his assistant. But I got the job, okay? Yes, I got the job probably because of my dad. And I went down there, and this great production designer, Stephen Grimes, who won an Oscar for Out of Africa, really helped me. And I went to the principal's office of a elementary school, and I said, listen, I need some of your kids. I need to get their names and addresses if they want to be in the movie. Then when the wardrobe people come down, we'll wardrobe them. And when we need them, they just go in. They've already got their wardrobe. And the principal of the school from the deep south said, Mr. Koch, none of little my white kids going to play with no N-words, are they?
Jesus.
And I said, well, no, this movie takes place in 1931. I was 19 years old. And then he looked at the top of my head. He said, Mr. Koch, he said, are you a Jew? And I needed wardrobe. And I said, yes. And he looked at me, he said, you know, I had never seen a Jew before up close.
Wow.
And I learned anti-Semitism and racism.
Jeez.
More than I'd ever thought about in my life.
And is that the first movie where you didn't become an assistant director?
Yes. What happened is the first day of shooting, the first had a bad ankle. He was an older man. He quit at 10 o'clock in the morning. The second became the first. We're in Bay St. Louis, Mississippi. I mean,
right. Nowhere.
And they said, well, this kid knows what he's doing. You're the second today.
Right.
And I was the second for a week. And then they brought down a new first because they didn't like the second becoming the first.
Right.
So this, the the second who became a first said, I'm not staying. You don't want me as a first. I quit. So it was a new first, and I'm still the second. I'm the only one with continuity on the movie.
Right.
The guy was a great first, but in the afternoon sometimes he would take a little, a little sip of something, and all of a sudden I'm running the set at 19 years old with Redford and Charlie Bronson and Robert Blake and all these people. And I was talking into the whistle and blowing into the walkie-talkie. But I finally, under fire, you learn. And I had been an organizer my whole life, right. So it worked.
And then you took that job and ran with it because that's where you work on Marathon Man and Rosemary's Baby and Chinatown. And
The Way We Were, Parallax View.
And you ultimately become an assistant director on Having to Wait, but then you also become an executive producer on that. How do you make that jump from being an assistant director to producer?
I had been a top AD, as you say. Yeah. I've done a lot of great movies.
Sure.
And I went to every agency in town saying, back up a second. I was about to do a movie, associate producer and first AD on a movie called Harry and Walter Go to New York with my friend Mark Rydell, Don Devlin, Dean's father, and Harry Giddes, who was where the name Jake Giddes came from for Chinatown.
Right.
And we were all in a room. It's about 12 weeks before shooting. And Don and Harry were having an argument with Mark Rydell. And I said, wait a minute, guys, Mark, if you do this, blah, blah, blah. And Harry and Don, if you do this, I think we can. And they all looked at me and said, yeah, he's right. And I said, that was the last day. I think I'm ready to become a producer.
That's great.
So I went to every agency in town at that time, which there weren't that many. And everybody said, oh, I know your father. What a wonderful man he is. And I said, thank you. And he said, you must be so proud of him. And I said, thank you. And they said, now, what do you do? And I said, well, I've been an assistant director. And what is this? You assist directors? And they said, well, we'll call you back. And nobody did, except one agent, a man named Evart Ziegler. He had a small agency called Ziegler Ross. They represented Pollock, Terry Malick, Robert Towne, William Goldman. I mean, it was really an elite group. And he said, I'll call you back. And 2 days later, he did. And he called me back and said, you have a good reputation, and I'm going to take you on. Within 2 days, he calls me and says, pick up a script now. And you're meeting with Mike Nichols at 4 o'clock in the afternoon at the Beverly Hills Hotel Bungalow.
Wow.
And I met with Mike, and that was going to be my first movie, producing and first AD to Mike.
Sure. Well, that's a perfect segue to talk about what an assistant director does. You do assist the director, but really the assistant director runs the set. You are responsible for all the people moving in exactly the way they need to be moving, everybody to be where they need to be. You're also responsible for making sure the actors move from one place to another. Give me a couple of great stories from either Chinatown or Marathon Man or Rosemary's Baby, because I know I've heard one about Nicholson and Polanski going at it on Chinatown because you gave Jack a TV to watch a Lakers game.
Yes. So I'm not going to tell that one. That's in the book.
So good. So, but this is a perfect segue to your book too, because you've had such an storied and amazing life with all these legends. I know that every AD that I know has a million stories because you're knocking on the trailer doors. You're the one who's saying, "Hey, right, let's go, Mr. Nicholson. You got to come to the set now." Can you think of any stories just off the top of your head that, like, I'm sure you have a thousand.
How many do you want?
Sure, as many as you want.
But let me just say that it's a perfect segue to be a producer more than a director.
Uh-huh.
Because ADs have to think about everything. They have to prep everything, and they have to be a psychologist to the actors, the directors, the other producers, the whole crew, so that when you're a producer and if you've seen like the whole of everything, that's the AD is a great lead into producing.
Mm-hmm.
One of the stories I love is I'm the second AD. It's day three of shooting, and Natalie Wood's going to be in her first day of shooting. And they say, go get Natalie Wood. And I run from the set to base camp, and I knock on the door. And she goes, yes. And I'm in love with Natalie. I mean, who wasn't? Splendor in the Grass, Love of the Proper Stranger, right?
How old are you then?
19.
You're perfect.
I'm 19. I mean, are you kidding? Natalie Wood. I barely got out. We're ready for you. And she threw the door. She says, oh, I'll be out in a few minutes. And I said, oh, well, James Wong Howe, Academy Award winning, amazing cinematographer, James Wong Howe said the light's perfect. They were ready for you now. And she opened the door and she looked at me and she took my arm and walked up to the set with me. And everybody said, how did you get Natalie Wood out of her trailer? She never comes out of her trailer. And I said, well, I heard James Wong Howe say the light's perfect. And I did that my entire career.
Oh, that's amazing.
I was able to go to actors and actresses and say, hey, DP said light's perfect. Let's go. You're going to look great.
Perfect.
Right?
Because otherwise you're dragging them around because they have stuff they're doing on their schedules. They, you know, they think everything can wait because it's all artificial anyway. That's brilliant.
Right. So that was a great learning experience at 19.
It is a great learning experience for producers too, because as producers, we have to have everyone be happy, because it's too long of a grind and too bad if it's not happy. Everybody's got to at least be rowing in the same direction. So I'm sure that was great training for you throughout your entire career.
Absolutely. And you know, they always say, what, producers have to put out fires? Yes. But producers have to stop the fires before they start.
Exactly.
You've got to be aware of what's going on and who's happy, who's not.
And an AD as well.
Absolutely. That's what I'm saying. It's a great road to being producer.
So working with all these great filmmakers, what was your biggest takeaway as an AD? What was the kind of the behind the scenes as an AD when you're working so closely with guys like Sidney Pollack and, you know, all these great actors and Roman Polanski, et cetera? What is kind of the main takeaway? Like, what did those guys have in common?
They were prepared. They knew what they wanted, and they knew how to get it. And each one had a different way to get it. Sidney was an actor, mm-hmm. and he knew how to get actors to really give him everything. He knew when to talk to them and when to leave them alone. Roman, nobody knew where to put the camera, how to put the camera, and the entire movie, what it should look like as a director, better than Roman. And Gordon Willis and Robert Benton, on a little movie we made, Benton's first movie as a director, called Bad Company, mm-hmm. with a young actor named Jeff Bridges,
sure.
in 1970. Gordon Willis taught me and taught directors, and I've used that ever since. 2 weeks before shooting, Gordy got me and Benton in a room for 2 hours every night after whatever we were prepping and said, okay, Bob, let's go scene one. Do you see it wide? Do you see it tight? Do you see it moving? Do you see it stationary? Do you see it high? Do you see it low? Do you see it bright? Tell me the transition. Do you want to go from a moving shot to a moving shot into scene two? Do you want to go from a proscenium to... And we went through the entire script that way.
Wow.
And Benton, and what Gordy says is we all have the opportunity to change our mind. But the AD, the DP, and the director all knew what we wanted mm-hmm. to get. And if you ever look at Bad Company, you'll see proscenium, proscenium, proscenium. Whew, whew, whew. Quick dolly, 100-foot dolly shots, fast, fast, fast. And then, boom, back to something important. I mean, it really is designed. And I think that the directors, most of the directors I worked with, the great ones, really had a design like an artist. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's all I can, like, you know, Monet or mm-hmm. Picasso or whoever. They really had a design of what they were going to do.
So you go from being an AD to being a producer, but all the while being an AD and even in that transition into being a producer, your dad has this incredible career. What was that like going from sets with, you know, as an AD to what was Hollywood like back then? Like, what was your social life? What was your day-to-day life?
Well, let me take you back a little bit.
Please.
Because in 1952, I'm 6 years old, and the phone rings at home, and the guy says, is your father there? And my father's name was Howard Koch. And I said, you know, like any six-year-old guy, no, can I take a message? And he said, you know, your father's, can I swear a little bit here?
Yeah, please.
Your father's a motherfucking sucking communist pig. And hung up the phone.
Jesus.
And of course, when my dad came home, any six-year-old, I repeated word for word what he said. Well, my dad was scared stiff because my dad was an AD. At the time, he was doing Julius Caesar with Mankiewicz and Marlon Brando at MGM. And it was at the time of the McCarthy, the Blacklist, everything. And there was a man named Howard Koch, who was the co-writer of Casablanca.
Oh, wow.
And had also written with Orson Welles, you know, of the famous radio
War of the Worlds.
And my dad thought, he was a young AD, and he had two little kids. He changed his name to Howard W. Koch. He added his middle initial so he wouldn't be
blacklisted.
He wouldn't be associated, and he could keep his job.
Right.
So Howard W. Koch was always important to my dad.
Sure.
And I was Little Howie.
You were Howard W. Koch Junior.
Junior. Right. And I was always Little Howie, and wherever I went in my whole life, it was when I met somebody, oh, do you know what a wonderful man your father is? Nice. You must be so proud. And I was proud, and I did love him. But this didn't happen every month or every week. This happened daily.
Wow.
My whole life. I remember when he was producing the Oscars in the 70s, and I was doing Chinatown, and the way we were, I'm the top AD. Everybody knows me. And I go down to the Dorothy Chandler to help Dad backstage and prep, and somebody introduces me, and they go, oh, your dad's the most wonderful man. Are you in the business? Right? It constantly was right there. So when I became a producer, all of a sudden I was like, oh, you know, I'm now a producer. Whether it was Heaven Can Wait or whether Gene Kirkwood and I, when we made The Idolmaker and mm-hmm. The Pope of Greenwich Village and Gorky Park and started going all these films. Then I ran Ray Stark's company. We mm-hmm. made Peggy Sue Got Married and Secret of My Success, Nothing in Common, a lot of good movies. Mm-hmm. And I thought, wow. You know, but no, I was still, and I don't know if you know the story of the bar mitzvah.
I do.
But a relationship had just broken up, and my dear friend Gary Lucchese, who actually used to be in these offices right down here.
Uh-huh. You were 50.
I was about to turn 50.
A lot going on.
A lot going on. I was in post on Primal Fear, pretty good, good movie. He said, I know you were never bar mitzvahed, and I've been to all your children's bar and bat mitzvahs. Can you get bar mitzvahed at 50? And I said, geez, Gary, I don't know, but that's a great idea. And quickly, I found a rabbi. I talked to him, and he said, well, who are you? And I said, oh, I'm a movie producer. He said, no, who are you? And I said, oh, I'm a father. He said, who are you? And scared the hell out of me, and I looked at him, and I don't know where it came from, but I said, oh, I'm a Jewish man. He said, great, that's a start. What's your Hebrew name? And I said, I don't have one. And he said, well, for your 50th birthday, for your bar mitzvah, you'll be given your own name. When he said that, I broke down.
Wow.
And he said, what is it? Because he didn't know me.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, I just realized for 49 years I've had my father's name.
Wow.
And he said to me, well, you can have your own name. And that's, remember, HWK, Howard yeah. W. Koch. And then I found a way to find the A in Hawk. That's where I came up with it. And he said, I asked him if it was pretentious. He says, only pretentious if you allow it to be. But hawks can see from horizon to horizon, and they can see like a squirrel a half a mile away. Wouldn't it be great if you could see the panoramic of your life and the detail always at the same time?
That's great.
And I think I became conscious then. And I think I became a lot deeper then. And I started to see things a lot differently then, having to go tell my father that I was going to change my name, which is, it's in the book.
Mm-hmm.
It's a quite a day.
Mm-hmm.
Now, right from then, in 1995, when I was introduced to people, this is Hawk Koch, they'd go, oh, what a cool name, or wow, what kind of name is that?
Right.
I realized, oh, they were talking to me as opposed to about my dad.
Right.
It's not that I didn't love my dad.
Right.
It was just that, you know, and then, I don't know, in 1989, he won the Gene Herschelt Award,
mm-hmm.
which is the humanitarian award at the Oscars. And when he got up there and he talked about all of us that were sitting in the audience, and he said, one day I hope that my son can be up on the stage at the Oscars. And I was like, oh, my God. I had no idea he felt that way.
Oh, that's amazing.
So that years later, when I actually was on stage.
Yeah.
I wished he'd been around to see that.
Right. You know? Well, that was a call to action for sure. And you became president of the Academy,
yes,
as well as the Producers Guild with Mark Gordon.
Yes.
So that must have been a call to action to do that. How long did you have that job in the Academy?
Well, I was on the board for 9 years, and the last year I was allowed to, like right now, I was going to term out. And several friends of mine on the board, great guy, several others, said, you know, now you should do it, either now or never.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wanted to be president, and I was president for a year. And I must say I'm very proud of all the things that got done in that 1 year.
Well, yeah, so. You did the Academy. You started the Academy Museum. You had a huge call for inclusion. You guys did a lot during that year.
Digital.
Yeah.
The costume designers got their own branch. The casting directors got their own branch. The makeup and hairstylists got a branch full.
Right.
We redid the offices. I don't know if you've been over to our offices on Wilshire.
Beautiful.
They're beautiful. And the museum and the first ever general membership meeting where,
right,
New York, LA, and up at Pixar, lots of people, we had questions, we answered. We wanted to be as open as we could about what the Academy is, and we wanted to hear from our members.
Before we keep going, let me tell you about Today Tix. I always thought Today Tix was for last-minute tickets, but what most people don't know is that you can buy tickets months in advance. So if you're feeling spontaneous or just want to browse, you know you're getting the best prices when you go through the Today Tix app. Right now, go to todaytix.com/guide and use promo code GUIDE to get $10 off your first Today Tix purchase. Today Tix is so convenient that Ford Magazine calls it the Uber of Broadway tickets. Find a show in your hometown or even while you travel. They offer tickets for theater, live comedy, dance, opera, immersive theatrical experiences, and more. And they're all more affordable than you think. There's something going on in your city and you don't want to miss out. Go to todaytix.com/guide and use promo code GUIDE to get $10 off your first Today Tix purchase. That's promo code GUIDE at todaytix.com/guide for $10 off your first ticket purchase. todaytix.com/guide. Go get them.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Hey, it's Todd. If you like what you hear or you have any questions about this podcast, please tweet at me at @Todd_Garner on Twitter. Look forward to hearing from you.
This is The Producer's Guide with Todd Garner.
Well, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you, what is going on with the Academy? Because you don't have to. I know you stabbed your heart. You don't have to tell. You don't have to tell me. But the thing from an outsider looking in, I was partners with Tom Sherrick for a while, and he was a great man and a great president. And it always seemed to me, and I've had DeLuca on here who produced the award show, and it is a huge part of the fundraising, I guess. Well, not fundraising, but it's a huge part of the revenue is that one award show. But it feels like
all of it.
Well, okay. So it feels like that award show is having a lot of hard time figuring out what it needs to be or what it should be. And I don't want to make this analogy, but it feels a little bit like the Miss America pageant. Like, it needs to figure out what it is, right? Because there is this very deep, very loud part of the Academy which wants to keep it the way it is, and obviously people who, you know, if they're a cinematographer, they should get their award, and they have been on television, and it should still be televised in their
mind. But at some point, it's a television show that has to get ratings and has to, otherwise, like you said, if it's 100% of the revenue, it better succeed. So it's daunting because it feels like no host, host, this host, that host, this thing. It doesn't feel like it's staying with the times as much as probably they're hoping. And that seems very scary to everybody that is in leadership in the Academy, correct?
To everybody at the Academy, I think leadership is where you're right. And the fact is nobody does know. I'm one of the few, or maybe one of the many, I don't know. I believe that the Oscar has to be for a theatrical motion picture. We've got Netflix, we're going to have Warners and Disney and Universal streaming,
right,
all making some terrific movies that play on television. And I want the Oscar to be for movies that are theatrical, okay, first. I don't want people watching Lawrence of Arabia on their phone, and say, oh yeah, I'm going to vote for that for best cinematography or best sound.
Right.
You know, it seems ridiculous. And whether it's a host or it's not a host, if somebody like Billy Crystal comes along or Bob Hope or Johnny Carson that can do it and make it kind of fun because everybody wants to see that person, great, have a host. Mm-hmm. It's people who love movies that I think have to be able to watch. And we may not have, you know, 35 or when I was president, 41 million people watching the show. But you can't try and copy something and run after something, right, that you don't know. Because also, up until, you know, well, it's been 20 years, but there was no Entertainment Tonight when Jack Lemmon or Walter Matthau or Clark Gable or Audrey Hepburn came on. You didn't get to see them every minute. You didn't get to know what doctor they were going to, and they had a nosebleed yesterday. Mm-hmm. And I think that takes away all the chemistry. Mm-hmm. And it's difficult. I know when I was president, I made a rule for all the people that were going to present that they had to sit in the audience because we didn't have enough people to shoot. We just kept shooting the same nominees, you know, mm-hmm, five of each. Mm-hmm. And so
I said, to stay, you mean?
So yeah, they have to stay in the audience so we could cut to all those.
Sure.
We had great presenters, mm-hmm, you know, but it hasn't continued, but I know Don Mischer, who was the director of the year I did it, mm-hmm, said, you know, I got nobody to cut to,
right,
except the same people. So the answer is I don't know the answer, but I know we have to keep trying, and we keep no matter what, anybody who does anything, whether they pass away or whether they get a new job, it starts with Academy Award nominee or Academy Award winner. It never says Golden Globe winner, right, People's Choice. So it's still the gold standard, and we got to find a way to keep it that way.
Who – I don't know if you guys ever spoke about this in your meetings is in the leadership because I'm in the Academy, but who is that show for? Is it for the people that get the awards, or is it for the people that love movies that are watching the awards?
Both. It's got to be.
That's
for
where
both.
The tug is, right? The problem is if you just strictly said it's just for the people watching, you'd make it an hour and a half and you would only have the top movies and you would this whole thing about popular movies versus other movies.
That's not going to
happen. But the problem is if the movies aren't the biggest movies, you're limiting yourself to the people who are going to be interested because you're limiting it to the more independent dramas, things like which has by definition a more narrow audience than these big, massive spectacle movies. But I'm saying so it is this bifurcation, this tug of like wanting to have the most people watch it to get to be just to be crass, to have the most revenue for the Academy, keep it robust. But also it's for the people that work their ass off and they deserve it and they're getting voted by their peers and they need to be acknowledged for that.
That's the key. They're being voted by their peers. Golden Globes, mm-hmm, what, 90 mm-hmm stringers, mm-hmm, right? The Critics' Choice in mm-hmm LA Critics is, you know, 15 critics. Mm-hmm. Cinematographers nominate cinematographers, nobody else. Mm-hmm. Art directors, production designers nominate production designers. Only the actors nominate the actors. Mm-hmm. I don't know that everybody knows that.
Yeah.
And then once everybody's nominated, we as Academy members, I'm sure you do the same thing, I look at everything.
Mm-hmm.
And if I haven't looked at something, I'm not going to vote in that category.
Mm-hmm.
But it's so exciting to be able to say this is the only show where the people who actually make the films,
yeah,
the best of the best, vote for the best of the best that year. And I'm sorry if you have to sit through it. You know, there's an awful lot of film students and mm-hmm. all over the world that want to go, wow, mm-hmm. that's John Bailey or that's right. James Wong Howe or Gordon Willis for cinematography or somebody else. Mm-hmm. Those are the people we're making it for. And we can't I'd rather see a show which honors all those people and do a little less if we don't have enough money.
Right. I see what you're saying.
You know?
Yeah, I mean, it's a daunting problem because, yeah, I mean, it's one thing to say, I'm sorry, but you have to sit through it. They don't have to sit through it. They can turn it off. And so that's the daunting problem.
DVR, then.
Exactly. That's the daunting problem is you want to make a show that's honoring all these craftsmen that deserve to be acknowledged, yet you're competing against the Super Bowl and, you know, Love Island or whatever it is. You know, that's just pandering to the lowest common
exactly.
denominator.
I don't want to pander.
Right.
I think the great directors, I don't think that Tarantino or Polanski or Pollock or Alan Pakula or Warren thinks about he's making the movie that he wanted to make.
Right.
And I think that we as the Academy should put on the best show possible so it's entertaining.
Mm-hmm.
I want it to be entertaining, but also honoring the people who should be honored.
Yeah. And do you think that since the ascension of independent movies and specifically during the kind of heyday of the Weinstein years in terms of promoting those movies to get those Academy Awards, do you think that – because back in the day, Cecil B. DeMille and these giant movies were, you know, Godfather and these, you know, were nominated, and now it just seems like more and more and more of those are sort of left by the wayside, and it wasn't always this bifurcation between populist movies and – quote-unquote independent or smaller, more dramatic movies, which now seem to be heading towards streaming. So if it feels weird, if the continuation is for those movies to be heading towards streaming while Disney and Marvel and DC and these things sort of take over the theatrical experience and all you want is for the theatrical movies to be on the Academy Awards, it seems inevitable that there may be an Academy Awards somewhere in the future where it's like five Marvel movies and two remakes of the animated movie because that's all that's being released theatrically. How do you do that?
Well, I'm hoping that doesn't happen. but you know, Around the World in 80 Days won the movie.
Exactly,
you know,
right?
So, which was
I'm saying it was back in the day the big
Gigi.
Yeah, those big theatrical movies were really all that the studios were making. It seems
right.
obviously cyclical.
They're cyclical.
Right.
I mean, somebody was asking me yesterday about comedies because I was talking about Wayne's World, you know,
right.
which was kind of the start in the
sure.
90s of that kind of stuff, and we didn't know,
right.
you know, we didn't know it was going to go to where it went, but we had Crazy Rich Asians last year,
yeah.
and we had Bridesmaids a couple of years before.
Yeah.
You've made a lot of
yeah.
– you've done very well with
yeah.
with really good comedies.
Not so much worried about the Academy Award in my set,
right.
my career, but no. still I've
hey,
made a lot of
– we got to give you a little credit there, Todd. You know, but I think it is cyclical,
yeah.
and I think that – as much as they all want to make a lot of money and they want the Lion King and Avengers, there's something inside them that also wants to make a movie that is,
mm-hmm.
You know, I look at Toby Emmerich, who's mm-hmm. a dear friend of mine. I did the movie that he wrote called Frequency
mm-hmm.
many years ago. Well, Toby's got, you know, he's got all these big DC movies and all this other stuff, but he's also got Edward Norton's movie, Motherless Brooklyn, coming
yeah.
out November 1st.
And he did Star Is Born with Bradley.
And he did Star Is Born.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, Star Is Born got nominated.
Yes.
Okay. So, I think Jimmy G is going to do that at Paramount. I think
Tom Rothman,
sorry,
okay.
yeah, is always you know, he did Tarantino's movie. Yeah. You know, he put it out in the summer.
Yeah.
Right? And it did business. I don't know if you've seen it.
I loved it.
I had a great time, and I grew up. I was in Los Angeles, so there was.
Yeah, so I said Rosemary's Baby and Chinatown they talk about.
I'm sitting in the theater watching, and there's on the marquee, when she's walking into the Bruin, on the marquee it says Pendulum. I was the second AD on Pendulum. I'm going, amazing. Wait a minute, I was on that movie.
That's great.
But it really was, you know, and I mean,
well, I didn't mean to go down the rabbit hole, Nick.
Sorry,
because no, it's okay. Because it is a daunting thing for the Academy to try and figure out, because people's viewing habits are changing, and there is the Independent Spirit Award. So it's like it becomes a very odd conversation, because it is diametrically opposed, those two things, the length of the show in conflict with how many people should get the awards on that award show. So the perfect segue is Wayne's World. So how did Wayne's World come to you? Because you come up from this, just the most amazing dramatic movies. I love Wayne's World, by the way. And then you did Heaven Can Wait, which is obviously a comedy, but do you love comedy, and how did that movie?
Oh, yeah.
How did that movie come about?
I did two really, I think, really good comedies: Peggy Sue Got Married and The Secret of My Success.
Gosh, Nick is good
for Ray Stark. Yeah.
Yes,
and I was doing a movie in Texas for Paramount when Lucchese, Gary was a young executive at TriStar when I made Peggy Sue and Nothing in Common. And now he's head of production at Paramount. He made me an exclusive deal as a producer. And the first movie I was doing was a film called Necessary Roughness, which was a lot of fun down in Texas. And Gary calls me up and says, do you know anything about Wayne's World? I said, yeah, I love it. I watch it on SNL. He said, well, we made a deal with Lorne Michaels, but we need a movie producer to work with him. Would you fly back and meet with Lorne? So I said, sure. And I called my three children. I think they were 21, 18, and 12.
The perfect focus group.
Right. I called him and I said, hey, do you think I should do this movie Wayne's World? All three of them. Dad, you got to do it. You got to do it. Right.
Exactly.
So I flew back, talked to Lorne. We had two different ways of working, but we were both producers. Mm-hmm. And it came together. And it was really interesting because Mike, who and Dana were television people.
Right.
The fact that I had experience as a movie producer,
sure.
There was a lot of respect there.
All due respect. Let me add on to that. Not just a movie producer, but somebody who's been on tons of movies granularly, down to the line item, down to this last minute. I mean, I always liked you, Todd. You're a line producer also. So
yes.
you know a set backwards and forwards, not only being in the business your entire life, your dad running that place where Lucchese is. I mean, the history you have in terms of being the right guy to be there to allow these guys to be funny because they hadn't done it before. You know, just not being a quote unquote movie producer, you had more than enough resume to be doing that movie.
Well, thank you. I love movies.
Me too.
So that's, no matter what it is, when I look at, you say, wait a minute, you did Chinatown and you did Wayne's World. Well, look at William Wyler did Best Years of Our Lives, The Collector, Ben-Hur, and then Funny Girl.
Well, look at Howard Hawks.
Yeah.
He did comedies and he did The Thing and he did Scarface.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's okay to be eclectic. Mm-hmm. So we got together and my oldest son, Billy, had been on lots of sets with me, and he just graduated from Northwestern. And I said, you're ready to be a key set PA. So he's up in rehearsal like 2 weeks before shooting, and he comes down at lunch and he says, Dad, now Billy was like 21 or something, and he says, Dad, it's the funniest thing I've ever seen in my life. And I said, what? He said, have you ever heard of Queen? And I said, yes. He said, have you ever heard of Bohemian Rhapsody? And I went, yeah, why? He said, wait till you see what Mike came up with. And they, in rehearsal is when it happened.
Oh, my God.
Okay. And I have one other wonderful story that I love about Wayne's World. I said my youngest son, Robbie, who's now a big entertainment lawyer at Hanson Jacobson, if any of you are looking for a great lawyer, he's really great. I know that because when Elizabeth Moss I saw one day, I used to be Howard Koch's son, now I'm Robbie Koch's father. I said to Elizabeth Moss, who I guess he represents, I said, I'm Robbie Koch's dad. Oh, what a sweet, kind, great guy. I said to him, well, how is he as a lawyer? He said, He's a pit bull, and I love him.
That's amazing.
So anyway, Robbie's on the set with me, and we're doing the scene where Robert Patrick from Terminator 2, the cop, walks up to the blue pacer, and he says, "You were speeding." And Robbie's standing with me and Penelope Spheris and Bonnie and Terry Turner, the writers, and Mike's in the car. And Robbie at 13 goes, "Well, that's not funny."
Oh, geez. Oh, no.
Oh, my God.
That's amazing.
And I'm thinking, oh, sure, you bring your kid to the set,
oh,
right?
Gosh.
And Mike, to his credit, said, "Why isn't it funny, Robbie?" He says, "Well, in Terminator 2, Robert walked up and had a Polaroid and said, 'Have you seen this boy?'"
Right.
Which was exactly what he did. And Mike and everybody went, "He's right." They took a Polaroid of Robbie, and that's in the movie.
Oh, that's amazing.
So Robbie always got laughs, and Robbie goes, "Yeah, I'm in Wayne's World."
He could be a producer. Anyway. And so this is another good segue to you being president of the Producers Guild, because this is important to me, because I don't really know what the Producers Guild does other than puts on this great, you know, Producers Guild thing. But we're not a union. We're a membership.
We're an association.
And I know that you guys, thank God, have this PGA stamp now, which is fantastic. But what do you think about the producer's credit? Because it's f***ed. Because there's thousands of them and anybody can get it.
Well, as a member, I was very early on in the Directors Guild when I joined in 1968. I was there in the AD-UPM Council, and we made it a lot. We got a lot of creative rights. And in 1999, I got a call saying, "Would you join the Producers Guild and would you run for vice president?" Chuck Freeze, actually. Mm-hmm. And I said, "You know what? I think the producer is." We had all had a meeting. You were probably up there at Dick Zanuck's house when they gave away their writer's credit, became the last credit before the director.
Yeah.
And we all got together and said what the hell we were going to do. And I said, "You know what? Yeah, I love making movies, but I also want to look out for the rights of producers." And we went from 350 people. I was able to get Kathy Kennedy to say she'd become president. And we went from 350 people. We now have 8,500 members of our association. We wanted to look out for the rights of producers, and we do. We gave away our award for the Producers Guild Award. We arbitrated. We set up a set of criteria of 40 different things that a producer does. And if you do a majority of those functions, you can win the award. Okay. Now, we worked behind the scenes at the Academy, me, Kathy, Mark Johnson, Larry Gordon, when we were all governors. And we wanted the Producers Guild to be the decision makers as to who wins the Oscar for Best Picture. The producer always gets it, not the executive producer, not the co-producer, not the whatever.
Co-associate.
Yeah, whatever. All the produced by credit is the important credit.
Right.
And we finally got the Academy to say yes. And when Mark Gordon and I became president, we said, we have to keep going. We have to find a way, because so many people, as you say, negotiate the credit. Somebody's brother, somebody's sister,
yeah,
somebody's carpenter gets the producer credit.
Mm-hmm.
And Vance said, what about the good seal of approval? Little P, little G, little A, next to the name of the person who actually did the work. As an actor, it doesn't say if Tom Hanks is starring in Captain Phillips, it's not starring Tom Hanks and Todd Garner as Captain Phillips.
Exactly.
No, it's Tom Hanks.
Right.
If it says directed by Quentin Tarantino, he directed it.
Right.
If it says, you know, but producer, it's amorphous.
There's three, sometimes there's 30 credits.
Right. So we went 2.5 years, Mark and I and Vance went to every studio, and it really was a strategy of how we got the first one, then we got the second studio. There's no more. It was a moral reason. There was no financial reason for them to do it. But finally, we were able to get all the studios and all the major independents to say yes to the mark. And now, last year, 380 films had the PGA mark on it. Mm-hmm. In seeing Quentin's movie the other night, and I look and the three producers, those three got the producer credit. I've seen a lot of movies.
The PGA.
The PGA stamp,
right.
mark.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? That's what we've done there.
Right.
We And it's not just producers. It's associate producers. It's production coordinators. It's VisFX producers. But we're all looking out for one another. And if I beg you, go to our website and look at all the things we do for everybody in our guild. Mm-hmm. And so it's a phenomenal place, even though we're not a collective bargaining mm-hmm. group. But I can't tell you how many people want the producer's mark yeah. because they want to say, wow, A, BAFTA, Golden Globes, Oscar, PGA, mm-hmm. all, if you don't get the mark, you're mm-hmm. not going to win the award. And it also says you actually did the work.
Yeah. Well, so, that's good. And I do. I get
and,
it. I always
and it, and it changed
I,
the
and
culture.
Part of that and fill
and,
that out.
And a lot of people who know they're not the real producer all of a sudden say, you know, I'll take exec producer or I'll take yeah. something else because they don't want to be shamed that they didn't do the work and they took the credit.
Right. That's good. And so yeah. I think for everybody who listens to this, it's important to look for that seal because yes. that is the biggest thing that has changed in the last 40 years.
Yeah, we changed the culture. And you don't have to be a member of the guild to get the mark. It has
right.
nothing to do with that.
Yeah.
It's that you actually did the work of a producer.
And let's talk about the Produce By Conference because you do them quite often in New York and Los Angeles. And what is the kind of North Star of the Produce By Conference?
Young people and people who want to be in the business and want to learn about everything that's happening today, and it happens so fast. We have the Produce By Conference in Los Angeles every June. We have the Produce By New York every October, mm-hmm. and so that because we have a very strong base in New York too of the Producers Guild, it's about there's probably in LA I would say 5-10 maybe. 12 or 14 different panels mm-hmm. dealing with everything that's going on in the entertainment business in television, in new media, and in movies. And in New York, it's probably 8 or 10 panels. And it's the best people in our business, the top people in our business want to show up and explain what's going on. Mm-hmm. This year Jeffrey Katzenberg's mm-hmm. talking about Quibi, you know, and everybody's understanding. And all of a sudden, I know a bunch of people said, oh, I was at the conference. I heard Jeffrey and I just got a deal at Quibi on a project because he learned something there.
Right. Right. So it's really for anybody who is really wanting to know everything that's happening in the business from the standpoint of producing, go to that conference and experience the top people talking about it.
Yes. Yes.
So let's talk about your book.
Yes.
What made you decide to do it?
I've been telling stories, as we all have,
sure.
on the set forever, and everybody says you've got to write a book.
Mm-hmm.
I have 3 kids and 5 grandsons, and I wanted my grandsons and my children to know who their father was or is. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to finally put the stories down that writers, directors, actors, you know, they wanted to hear them. And I found a spine. The spine is getting out from under the shadow of a very, very well-loved man in the industry and having the same name and dealing with that spine. It's a love story between a father and a son, mm-hmm. but there are a lot of issues between my father and I that are explained in the book. And also, it's a kind book. If you're looking for something you're going to find in Vanity Fair and you're going to, oh, wow.
Right.
No, it's good stories, fun stories, funny stories. But, you know, it's if I can, I just want to – because – you know, I worked with Edward Norton on his first movie, Primal Fear,
mm-hmm.
and then I produced a movie he made called Keeping the Faith
yep.
that he directed. But and Edward's a dear friend, but this is what he wrote about the book. So mm-hmm. this is, and I'm doing the audio in 2 weeks.
Oh,
I'm
fantastic.
Very excited about that. Hawk Koch is without a doubt one of the great Hollywood storytellers I've ever known. His adventures in the movie business are so funny and so incredible that I retell stories from his career more than the ones from my own. And his own personal journey is as heartfelt as it gets. And Jane Fonda, who's been I worked with Jane on Barefoot in the Park in 1966, so I've known Jane a couple of years.
Yeah.
And Jane is also her father's a little more famous than mine, but still he was, you know, I asked Jane to read it and Jane wrote, "I can personally relate to this moving journey of a man learning to step out from under a father's shadow. But Magic Time is also filled with fun, surprising stories that only a deep insider could tell."
That's great.
And so those, I mean, there's others from Mike Myers and Redford and Mark Gordon, Gail Ann Hurd, a lot of others, but, I'm really proud of it.
That's great.
And it's really fun. I'm putting together the book tour and I'm in pre-production.
Well, that's awesome.
And
when does the book come out? November?
November 12th.
And when does the audio come out? Same?
Same day,
oh,
I understand.
Excellent.
And it's really fun. I mean, you know, one of my mentors was Bob Evans, and everybody goes, you're gonna talk like Evans?
let me tell you my story about Bob Evans. I was a young executive at Touchstone. And he, same thing. He wrote the book and came out with the audio at the same time. And I was living in the West Side and I was obviously commuting to Burbank every day. And I heard the book and I was obsessed just with the way he tells the stories and just the way his rhythm of his voice was. And I went out that year, because I think it probably did come out right around November. So it's very similar. I went out and I bought 100 cassette tapes of the book on tape and gave them out to everybody in the business. Then,
about, what are you doing this November?
I got you, buddy. Well, you're on this podcast.
Okay.
So then I got a call from a reporter. I can't remember. It was LA Times, probably. And said, "I'm doing a retrospective on Bob Evans. He says you're his eyes and ears in young Hollywood." And I go, "What?" And he goes, "Yeah, he heard that you gave out 100 tapes of copies of his book." I'm like, "It's amazing. It's like I'm a giant history nerd. I am obsessed with the history of Hollywood. He is embedded in the fabric of the history of Hollywood, also embedded in the fabric of the corporatization of Hollywood, which is fascinating to me." So I can't wait to hear your book on tape, my friend. And of course, I will tell everybody about it. Now,
and I go see Evans every 6 weeks. And
well, he's amazing.
And if you ever want, I'll take you up there.
Knew him sort of tangentially, but yes, I'm going to take you up on that offer for sure. How did you do it? How did you write the book? Walk me through the process you went through to write this book.
About 4 years ago, my wife Molly, who's a Jungian analyst, and I were going to go up to Ashland, Oregon. We decided, all right, we're finally going to do it. We've been talking about it a long time. I wrote down all over 65 movies in order of the movies that I worked on. And it's a 10-hour drive up from L.A. to Ashland, Oregon. We were going to look, is there a property up there we want to buy or something? And she'd hit me with the name of the book of the movie. And then I'd tell the story of, oh, there's a couple of good stories in that movie and what was happening in my personal life and what was going on with my parents.
Oh, wow.
And so we literally in 10 hours did a whole bunch of early stuff. And then we kept refining and refining. And about a year and a half ago, we said, okay, now we're ready to really put it together. And I was going to just self-publish. I didn't think maybe, you know, who's going to want to read this? And we worked on it, and I gave it to an old friend of mine, a woman named Amy Bookman, who used to be a top lit agent at CAA, married to Bob Bookman at one point. Amy was a very good friend of mine. We met in 1983 when she represented CAA at Raystar, when I was president of Raystar. And Amy, knowing me and really smart, literate person, worked with us and said, "Now you can't say that, and you got to say that, and what about this?" And we, I would say, 2 months of really, really getting down. And I'm represented by the Gersh Agency, and they have a wonderful book agent named Joe Veltre in New York. So when we thought, okay, this is as far as we can go, let's give it to Joe. And I gave it to Joe and said, "Let me know what you think." And I was, you know, nervous as hell. He called me, said, "Wow, I think it's really good, and I want to give it out to some publishers." And I went, "Okay." He said, "Now, don't get your hopes up. You know, movie books, no dime a dozen, and right, nobody wants to see but everything. But I'm going to send it out to a few things." A week later, he calls me, said, we've got Post Hill Press, this company that is distributed by Simon & Schuster, and it's a boutique publisher. And I talked to the woman, her name is Deborah Englander, and all of a sudden, I'm doing it.
Wow.
And it's a lot different than being a producer for a studio or an independent, because I said, I'd like it to be, and they went, yes.
Wow.
I said, what?
You're not that used to that. You say yes. Nobody says yes anymore. Right. Everybody says no.
They said, you can put in 20 pictures in the book. And I said, well, I can't. I've got 30. And they said, okay. And they said, well, you could put it all in one place. I said, no. You have to show these pictures before this other thing happens. And so, I mean, they've been fantastic. And now the amount of, for those of you who are in New York on November 8th, Helen Mirren and I are going to do an event at the Robin Williams Center in New York City the night before PBNY. We're going to talk about acting and producing.
Oh, that's great.
Mark Gordon and I are going to do 92nd Street Y in January sometime. There's book parties and events. And
it's amazing.
So I'm excited. And it's like it gives me something else to do while I'm waiting for some fine answer.
No.
Exactly.
So a couple of questions I always ask. You have been doing this. Obviously, you were in the business since you were born, basically going to sets when you were a child, and you forged your own way by becoming a PA and going up through that route, being an AD and being a line producer and then a producer. What advice would you have for somebody trying to do it now?
First of all, show up.
And read your book. First of all, read your book.
I think there are some good things in the book.
I wouldn't doubt it.
Yeah. First of all, show up. There's a moment when I was doing Properties Condemned, and I'm in the bathroom, and two guys from the set walked in, and one guy said to the other, hey, you know, the reason that guy Koch kid got the job is because his dad's had a Paramount. And I just, you know, I was so deflated. And the other guy said, yeah, but you know what? He's working harder than anybody else, and he's a really good guy, so why don't you give him a break?
Nice.
And I knew that moment that I had to work harder than anybody else. And you know this as well as I do. Day one of shooting, there's four or five PAs that come in front and meet the producer and the director, and the AD or the production manager introduces all of us. And you know as well as I do that within a couple hours, you know that person's going to make it. Mm-hmm. That one could care less.
Yep.
You have to be so focused. You have to know what you want to do. I talk about five things that I do in my life that I've learned, and number four is have courage. Most people live in fear. You can't be afraid to do what you believe in. And you have to live your dream. If what you want to do is produce, mm-hmm. then you're lucky. Today you can produce. You can go out with your iPhone and make a movie. Mm-hmm. And if it's good, believe me, somebody's going to see it. We couldn't do that,
right?
You know? And show up. Show up for your family. Show up for your friends. Show up, because if you show up, people will notice. Mm-hmm. And that's as much advice as I can give. Mm-hmm. And go to movies. See all the movies. Mm-hmm. See them all. I mean, you and I, and my pal Mark Gordon, I'll say a line and you'll go, oh, from so-and-so in the third act of so-and-so.
Yeah, sure.
Because we know. And when you're talking to a director and you're talking to, as a producer, if you're talking to a director, you're talking to actors, you're talking to a cinematographer, mm-hmm. and you talk about that shot in that movie from 20 years ago, all of a sudden they have respect for you, that you are in the same place they are. Mm-hmm. I mean, Edward and I, when we're getting ready to make Keeping the Faith, Edward said, do you know that scene in Jules and Jim? I said, do I know it? I did it, you know?
That's always good when you can say that.
right. But I'm saying, and we did a scene like Jules and Jim, and it was because he saw that and that told the story. You're going to be so much more ahead of the game. And if you're a PA, if you're a second AD, if you're working for a producer, and you're sitting in his office and you want to be on the set or you want to be in a meeting with somebody, be ahead of the game. Prep. Yeah. You're going to, you know, some writer's going to come in and talk to Todd Garner. And instead of just saying, you know, Joe Blow is coming in, you can say to Todd Garner, Joe Blow's coming in. I've read three of his scripts. Here's what I felt was good. And all of a sudden you're going to look at that kid and go, wow.
Right.
Right?
Right. I have on my phone, right above my phone is a sticker that says, how can I help you? because that's all we can do. We can only, that's only as valuable as we are, is how we can help. And seeing every movie is so easy now. When I was coming up, you had to go to Vidiot's, and I would always try to go through. I went through all of Preston Sturges, all of Howard Hawks, all of Lubitsch, all of Spielberg, all of Scorsese. You had to go down, find them, pull them, rent them. You can get everything online now. There's no excuse not to do it.
Exactly. I have twin grandsons. One's, believe it or not, 23 years old. He's already in the union. He's working on American Horror Story.
Nice.
And his twin brother is an actor in New York and just did a tiny little movie. And when they were going to college, one at Chapman and one at Pace in New York, I said, here's the 100 best movies from AFI. You better watch all of them in the next year.
Yeah.
And they did. And they understand.
And they can. It's so easy to do it.
And no matter what craft you want to be in this business, starts out, you're a storyteller. Okay. If you learn how to tell a story, anybody can – well, not anybody, but people can be an editor or a cinematographer, but they have to know how to tell a story.
Yep.
And that's what a producer does. It's what a writer does. Director, yep, is tell the story.
I always ask this question at the end, my friend. Best day on set.
Best day on set. I think doing the Super Bowl, and we had 14 minutes at halftime of a Rams-Steelers football game. Warren was in the scene, so Billy Fraker and I were, and Buck, were putting it together. We had six cameras. We only had 14 minutes, and Warren couldn't come back and say, how does it look? He had to keep doing the scene. And when it was over, not only had we gotten the climactic shot of the movie,
sure,
where Warren scores the touchdown,
yeah,
and the whole thing.
Warren jumps into the body, and then
right,
he's right, Warren Beatty,
right,
and scores
right,
the touchdown.
Right.
We should say Buck Henry, who wrote the Heaven Can Wait.
And Elaine May.
Yes.
When it was over, I was wearing a T-shirt and a jacket, just because it's a chilly night, and I looked down. And it was sopping wet,
wow,
through the shirt, through the jacket. Just, but you know what? We all looked at each other and said, wow, we pulled it off.
Oh, my gosh.
We pulled it off. And it started because I had done Parallax View with Warren at a little place called The Hideaway at the Beverly Wilshire. It was a little bar. And he called me and asked me to, said, how would you put together the Super Bowl? And being a sports fan that I am, I had this vision of how I would do it. And we did it.
Wow. That gave me chills.
Yeah.
Well, my friend, good luck with your book.
Thank you.
I'm so excited for you. Congratulations. Everybody can get it November
12th. You
12th.
Can pre-order on Amazon or Barnes & Noble right now.
Magic time.
Yeah.
And thank you for doing this. It really means a lot to me.
And by the way, you're a hell of an interviewer and a hell of a producer. And it was really fun.
Thank you, brother.
Really fun.
Thank you.
You got it.
Thanks for tuning in to this week's episode of The Producer's Guide. We're produced by Kirsten Woodward and Steve Delamater. I want to answer all your questions about the business, so make sure to tweet me at Todd_Garner or use hashtag Producer's Guide on Twitter. See you next week.
Thanks for listening to The Producer's Guide with Todd Garner. Download new episodes every Thursday on PodcastOne.com, the Podcast One app, and Apple Podcasts. Make sure to rate and review on Apple Podcasts.
Do you know that every car comes with a chair of stories? That ding in your bumper when you nervously picked up a first date, the luxury package you got after a big promotion, or the mileage you saved by riding your bike all summer. While you can't put a price tag on your stories, now with TrueCar, you can at least find out what your car is worth when it's time to sell it or trade it in. Just go to TrueCar, simply enter your license plate number, and watch how your car's details pop up. Then answer a few simple questions. Once you're finished, you'll get a true cash offer sent in minutes, which you can take to a local certified dealer to cash out or trade in. So when you're ready to experience a better way to sell or trade in your car, check out TrueCar today. True cash offer not available in all areas.